Hello. Hello. Are you ready? All right. I'm going to give you a very brief introduction, mostly because I'm so excited that our theme speaker is here. Our theme speaker currently has served in lots of places, and I think maybe initially or early on at Akron. Grew up at Akron, so hails from Akron, a local girl. Comes to us today from Minnesota, yeah, and is now serving as the head minister for the Church of the Larger Fellowship, to which I belong. And so when I joined the committee and Meg was already lined up for this year and they said that's who's coming, I said, fantastic. And that was just about the time that she had joined Church of the Larger Fellowship. So I've met her primarily electronically before today, and very thrilled to have her here. So if you're ready, please join me in welcoming Reverend Meg Riley.
Hello. It is an honor and a privilege to be here. And I have a friend who says that the more someone stands up and says it's an honor and a privilege to be somewhere, the more they secretly don't want to be there. But in my case, I really do want to be here. So in case you have the belief of my friend, it's not right in this case. But it really is an incredible honor in this time to have this amount of time to spend with a group. Is that just going to stop on its own and I can quit glaring at it? Okay. I must admit that 18 months ago when I agreed to do this, I visualized a personality transplant that would have me have written a book, which I would present to you today. Inevitably, I end up with shreds of napkins instead. That's just my personality. I was saying this to a friend, I was saying, darn it, I really thought I'd have it together this time. And she said, so you thought you'd be a different person. So anyway, our strengths and our weaknesses, right? So how many of you have little devices with you that look like this in some kind of way? Great. I can tell you, how many of you are wired right now in this room? My experience is that the back of the room is pretty bad for wiring, and the front's a lot better. I know, you thought I was going to say turn them off, because that's what people always say. I'm going to try something different. I was reading a professor of communications who was saying, instead of turning it off, just turn it upside down and keep looking at it if you need to feel secure. But you don't need to use it all the time. But there will be times this morning when I'll actually invite you to use it in creative ways. So you can know that will happen today, but that you don't have to get maybe every time it vibrates a little, you don't have to see, because probably Michelle Obama just wants more money. So you can just pause and know that a little later. Actually, I have a friend named Michelle who said, I'm not getting my emails answered anymore. People keep telling me they hit delete when they see the word Michelle. So when I accepted this, I accepted it thinking it would be a great thing for me because I could come with my father. I've come here with him a couple of times. I was theme speaker in 1997, and he was here, and then I came back a couple more times. And so when I accepted, I actually thought it was for 2011, and he sent out a thing to the whole family saying, let's all go. And then I said, oh, no, it's actually 2012. And he said, well, if I'm alive, I'll go then. And I thought, oh, you drama queen. But darned if he didn't have to prove himself right, and he died around Thanksgiving time. So this one's in honor of Charlie. Those of you from Akron know him. And those of you here may know him. And my brother Will, who ended up being the only family member brave enough to come, has vowed to channel him from time to time by either falling asleep or yelling bah humbug as I talk. So when I came the first time in 1997, I was literally poised to go to China to adopt a baby, like immediately afterwards. We were there, July 17th was our adoption date. And if you were here, you probably are thinking, I don't remember you mentioning that. And that's because at the time I was so scared as an open lesbian that one person could blow the whole adoption, that it was this huge secret I stood up here with, and I never told anyone that I was, I mean, except everyone that I talked to privately, but I never said it publicly from here. I got so nervous that week, I thought I was having a heart attack and saw the masseuse who said, it's anxiety, dear, it'll be okay. But I was here with both of my parents were alive then. I was here with them, my brother-in-law and sister and their toddler daughter, and spent a lot of time, I remember at lunch, motivating Nico, the little 2-year-old, to eat. So then we came back after my mom died, my dad and me and my then partner, my niece Nico and our daughter Gia. And my dad was so awkward that year. It was the first year after my mom died that he never sat with us at meals or at theme talks or anything. It was really frustrating. I was really annoyed by it because, of course, I was here primarily to spend time with him. And Denny Davidoff, an old friend of mine, was theme speaker. And I said to her, he's driving me crazy. And she said, you know, he's probably so awkward and needy without your mom and the family. He has no idea how to fit together. It turns out from talking to my brother that my father just liked to have his seat and his way, and if you didn't know that and sit there, he didn't sit with you. But I didn't know that at the time. That was the year that my daughter, Gia, began her first of many gender-bending experiences and identified as John the Pirate all week in preschool, where everyone just called her John the Pirate with absolutely no problems. And my niece Nico, who was a few years older, was so overwhelmed in the Bethany dining hall that at meals she would only meow like a cat. And my then partner was not yet diagnosed with chronic fatigue syndrome, but she did get very tired here, and we started to wonder what was going on. So all of that is to say that this community means a lot, not only to me, but to my whole family. My brother Will, my posse here, has come with a number of times with his own wife and kids, and his now 30-year-old daughter emailed me on my way and said, you know, Will wanted me to convince your kid to come, and I didn't want to try to push her, even though I still talk every day to the friends I made 15 years ago at Summer Institute. She says that this place changed her life, even though she's now, you know, married and professional person, she absolutely remembers it. So you're all starting to think, okay, this is very friendly, but this is the longest personal kind of anecdotal thing. Could you get to the point already? Some of you are thinking. But what I've been talking to you about is embodied living. Lives in our bodies involve death and birth, adoption, marriage, divorce, illness, friendships, gender orientation, sexual orientation, aging, comfort, discomfort, death. In short, life in our bodies involves hanging onto our hats for the ceaseless change, which is the only thing we can count on, whether we call it positive or negative change. It's what we're doing. At age 56 now, I've watched men become women and women become men. I've watched blushing brides become bitter divorcees and bitter divorcees become blushing brides. I've watched Democrats become Republicans and Republicans become Democrats, and I'm not even going to get into third-party candidates or Canada. I've watched healthy people get sick and sick people get healthy. I've watched gay people becoming straight and straight people becoming gay, and a lot of people saying maybe most of us are actually bisexual. I've watched rich people get poor and poor people get rich and lonely people find companionship and people with a lot of companions become lonely. I've watched Christians become pagans and pagans become Christians. Fat people become skinnier and skinnier people become fatter. I've watched young people become older. And I did see that movie Benjamin Buttons with Brad Pitt in it. And I've watched people who are alive become people who are dead. This poem from Marie Howe is called What the Living Do. She wrote it right after her brother John died from AIDS. I read this a number of times at home, and my daughter finally said to me, you have to pay me $1 if you cry next time. So, I think I've got that out of my system. So she says this. Johnny, the kitchen sink has been clogged for days. Some utensil probably fell down there. And the Drano won't work, but smells dangerous. And the crusty dishes have piled up, waiting for the plumber I still haven't called. This is the everyday we spoke of. It's winter again, the sky's a deep, headstrong blue, and the sunlight pours through the open living room windows because the heat's on too high and I can't turn it off. For weeks now, driving or dropping a bag of groceries in the street, the bag breaking, I've been thinking, this is what the living do. And yesterday, hurrying along those wobbly bricks in the Cambridge sidewalk, spilling my coffee down my wrist and sleeve, I thought it again, and again later, buying a hairbrush. This is it. Parking. Slamming the door shut in the cold. What you called that yearning. What you finally gave up. We want the spring to come and winter to pass. We want whoever to call or not call, a letter, a kiss. We want more and more and then more of it. But there are moments, walking, when I catch a glimpse of myself in the window glass, say the window of the corner store, and I'm gripped by a cherishing so deep for my own blowing hair, chapped face, and unbuttoned coat that I'm speechless. I am living. I remember you. This is what the living do. We change every minute of every day. Some of those big life things, births and adoptions and deaths. I've gone back 15 years and just given a small snapshot of change in my own family. And I invite all of you now, give the introverts a moment to think here. Give anyone who's brought pen and paper a chance to write, and give gadget users a moment, if you want to catch up with whatever will ease your anxiety. And we'll play a song while you do this. And as you think about, as you listen to the song and are with yourself, just reflect back on the last 15 years in your life and the life of the people closest to you. You can make that full screen, right? Great. This is a song I heard the other night on the radio that just blew me away.
There is a whiff of mortality in the air, and that might explain why so many people want to go faster and do more. Because for a huge group, which happens to include my friends John Linnell and John Flansburgh and their band, They Might Be Giants, they've noticed that time is running out.
Marching on, and time is still marching on.
This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner, and now it's even sooner. This day will soon be at an end, and now it's even sooner, and now it's sooner still. You've ever been, and now you're even. you've ever been, and now you're even older, and now you're older still.
Thank you. Now you are older still. Soon to become a baby boomer anthem because...
Baby boomer anthem. Well, now we're all older. As Click and Clack used to say, you've wasted another hour with us. So I invite you to take a moment and turn to somebody near you and just share with them as you've thought about the last 15 years in your life. And I know for some people that's half your life. And for some people, that's a quarter of your life. And so these are going to be different kinds of narratives. So try to get with somebody who's not exactly your same age. But just to spend a few minutes sharing what embodied change has happened with you, and now you're even older, with you and the people that you love in the last 15 years. So take a couple minutes each to share. Here it is. Oh, I'm okay. I've got it. I'm just picking one. Okay. Hello. So hopefully, even from that little bit of sharing, you can feel that we're all part of this river of change all the time in our bodies. Tomorrow I'll say a lot more about embodiment. Today I just want to kind of introduce the topics of the week. And one thing I'll say is that the Facebook page of Ohio Meadville District is up with a post from Cliff, who said, I never post things like that, looking kind of miserable, but he posted it nonetheless, asking people if you want to share. He asked, actually can't read it. Post significant embodied changes have you experienced? What significant body experiences? Anyway, you can comment. You can read it and comment if you're on Facebook, and then you'll enter that river as well. There's also a Twitter account for this Summer Institute, OMDSI, UUOMDSI. And if you're a tweeter, how many people use Twitter in here? I noticed only one person had tweeted earlier. So a few of you. It's not really that fun just to tweet to yourself, so, you know, you might kind of... go where there are people and get into the river here. That's the point of this, so... So here's what I wanted to say by way of introduction to this topic. One thing I really love about Unitarian Universalism is that we don't talk about incarnation the way that many Christians do, which is that it's something that one person who became a God did a really long time ago. That would be Jesus. We say that each night a child is born is a holy night. We say that all of us are in the image of the divinity. And that's true also for many Christians. I'll say you Christians and other Christians of all kinds. Most of us agree with William Blake, who said, "Jesus Christ is the only God, and so am I, and so are you." That's why we've been a heresy for a long time. But we're located within a huge contingent of not only Christians, but Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists and all kinds of other people who really look to the text and wisdom of the body as a teacher. I think it's important to locate us there because sometimes I think we start feeling so special that we feel very lonely. And we're special, but we're really not that special. We don't have to be that lonely. So I'll talk a lot more about that. Tomorrow, I wanted to spend a little bit of time introducing this other theme of the digital age that we live in. I was complaining to a friend about this theme is so weird and odd, and these two topics are just strangely juxtaposed. And she said supportively, "That is a really weird theme. Who picked it?" To which I had to say, me. End of conversation. The second friend said, "Well, that's not weird at all. You're talking about, you know, how hard it is to be embodied in the digital age, and the digital age is really the enemy of all embodiment." And I said, "You know that I run an online church, right? So that's probably not what I'm going to say." It's part of what I'll say. It can be. It's complicated, as the Facebook relationship status can read. It's complicated. So if I thought that tech was just, as my friend said, crap in our lives, and sometimes I do, particularly when I'm in line and someone in front of me is on a cell phone giving TMI about their private life, but I also believe that it can help us to be more grounded, more connected, more fully here. When I was in seminary, which I started almost 30 years ago, this is the thing about aging. I don't know about other people who are aging, but I'm constantly counting decades on my hand because I can't believe that it's true. So I'll go, "Really? 80 to 90, 90? It is, 30 years ago." It's kind of awful, but there you have it. So anyway, in seminary, even then it was a long time. It was an old book. We read this book, Richard Niebuhr's classic, called Christ and Culture. It was a 1951 book. And in this book, he talks about how Christians might understand Christianity and Christ to be related to culture. And he lays out five possibilities for it. He said Christianity can seem to be in opposition to culture. It's against culture. Everything about culture is bad. Everything about Christianity is good. And they're in eternal war. And we see this with groups like the Amish who have withdrawn from culture. We also see it in the people who proclaim the culture wars and really want to be culture warriors on various issues, that, you know, culture's evil. So another way to understand the relationship of Christianity and culture, and I would translate Christianity here to faith and culture. So another way to understand the two is that faith has no conflict with culture. It's of culture, it's in culture, there's no problem here. It's just one and the same. And when I took this class years ago at a UCC seminary, Unitarian Universalism was placed into this category when we learned about it, which I didn't like much. I was like, no, I'll tell you the category I wanted to be in later. But there is truth to it. You know, Peter Mayer sings that beautiful song, "Everything is Holy Now." And there is a lot of truth to the fact that we really do say, yep, all of it, part and parcel, the good, the bad, the ugly, it's all where you find the holy. So that's another way to be with it. In another one, faith is above culture. So it's better than culture. Culture's here, faith is here. Faith is very pure, culture is very dirty. And anytime faith gets dirty, it's just because culture rubbed off on it, and you should try to separate the two. You know, it doesn't even need to relate to culture. I think of it kind of like the Vatican. It's its own country here. You know, it's infallible. It's just right up here. This is not to say this is how all Catholics live at all, believe me. But it's to say it's an approach to what faith means and that it's just better than, it's above. Another one is that it's in constant conflict with culture, that it's a paradox that we have both, you know, we're of the faith and we're of the culture and we're constantly fighting with those two, which I can partly relate to. And then the final one is that faith transforms culture. We do this by celebrating culture and recognizing that it's part of creation, but also lifting up the fact that we want to create a culture that's more like what our faith calls us to be. And of course, you'll know that's where I wanted Unitarian Universalism to be located. And I actually think that we are in a tension between transforming culture and being in culture that's of interest. But I thought this was a helpful way to think about the relationship of faith and technology, because technology is essentially just part of our culture. So can you put that slide up? Keeping him busy over there. And actually, I should say that the title of this this week came from a fight with a colleague who basically is of the faith is against digital media. He's a guy who's doing a very expensive building renovation in a large church and putting no money into social media, and I'm fighting with him all the time about it. And he said to me, "We worked really hard to establish an embodied theology and an embodied faith. Why are you trying to throw all that away?" And that's the week that I was asked for a title, hence I gave it. But I think really a more appropriate title is Embodied Faith in a Digital World, because theology implies studying from someplace that's a little bit separate. So here are the ways that I've thought about the relationship of faith and technology, which will sound very familiar to you because I just laid them out, but that some people think that technology and embodiment, like my friend, are in opposition and there's just no meeting ground. And so, you know, it's a fight. Another is that, hey, technology, go for it. What's the problem? You know, it's all great. Everything's good about it. Another is that faith is better than technology. We use technology, but it kind of dirties us a little. But, you know, faith is located above it somehow, but we use it as we have to. And others, that there's constant tension. And a final one is that embodied faith can transform technology. That's my personal belief, and that's what I'm going to talk about this week. Though certainly all of those others figure in at various places. Clay Shirky, who's one of my mentors in this world, whose book is for sale in the bookstore, says that now is the most interesting time around social media because it's ubiquitous, it's everywhere. And now that it's everywhere, now the culture of it gets established. It's not the technology anymore. Now we're figuring out what it all means. So I'll be talking much more about that later. But as I think back 15 years ago to where I was with technology, and I invite you to think back, I still had a VCR to tape TV shows that I missed. Though they were available, I did not yet have a cell phone, much less a smartphone. When I went to China to adopt Jia, I logged onto AOL, for which I paid about 3 times to write very quickly home and send it. And that was only in very fancy hotels that I could do that. No one on my trip had a laptop. Making phone calls home was exorbitantly expensive. When I went back 10 years later, you know, cheap calling cards, we all had laptops, we all could log on in every cafe for free. Wild changes. In 2004, I moved to Minneapolis from D.C. and continued working at the UUA and began to supervise people in Boston, D.C. and internationally. I began to use instant messaging and Skype. Now I run a church that, while based in Boston, has staff all over the U.S. and hopefully eventually all over the world. For me, my iPhone was the gateway drug that got me here. unbelievably enough, these are now 5 years old. They were launched June 29th, 2007. I didn't get one immediately, but we went to stay at a friend's house who lined up that first day. We went that next week, and my daughter said, who was then 10, "Can I spend the night here?" And it wasn't because she loved my friend so much. She played with that iPhone all night. By morning, she knew everything about it. I bought one a few months later, and I had to go to the Apple store a number of times before it became intuitive to me. But once I got it, I had crossed the digital divide, as they say. And for the first time in my life, felt competent with technology. So when I go to the store now, if I'm supposed to get something for someone and there are 10 choices, I take a picture, text it to them. Is that what you wanted? You know, I videotape. I saw people shooting footage of the screen this morning. I videotape interesting things. Someone will say something to me and I'll go, wait, can I just record that? I use dozens of apps, including the CLF app. I'll talk more about that later. I now have 64 gigabytes on this thing, which is probably more than my computer had 15 years ago on it. It's awesome. The first computer I ever used took up a room, right, with those punch cards. So it's just a different world. And I worked with a bunch of young people in the DC office, interns, who talked relentlessly about Friendster, this social media thing they were on, and also something called Fuse. Did anyone here, or any of you, part of Fuse? All right. Fuse was before there was Facebook. It was a UU social media, and from what I've heard, thousands of young adults were just absolutely connected through it, and then Facebook came along, and the rest is history, and the center people of that will still almost cry when they talk about it. But to me, you know, that social media stuff seemed like something the young people did and I should leave alone. But eventually one of the interns just said, sit down, I'm getting you on there, you need to see Facebook. And I'd been impressed by how quickly they could turn people up for events and things. So as an organizer, I wanted to know what it was. So the week that Barack Obama came into office, I got on Facebook and my first password was, I am cool now. And the 3 years since, my passwords have included, I hate Facebook and I don't care. But that's just when I'm feeling crabby, because Facebook is an integral part of my life, and I'll talk later about how we're using that at CLF to build community. I have a lot of opinions about social media that I'll share, but I'm really curious to hear from you, from those of you, and some of you were kind of like, oh yeah, I do that when I was doing that. But I'd like to go to this continuum and just kind of get a read of the room, because it was really hard to prepare this week, not knowing, you know, people are in such different places. And if I start with my joyful passion for this, there are so many people who are like, really, you know? So I thought it would just help me to get, and this isn't so that I can say you're smarter, it's really to get a sense of the room. I hope that wherever you are on there, you feel really good about it. So I'm just going to ask for a show of hands. So how many of you do think that all of this stuff like this is in opposition to embodiment? Primarily, that's where you'd locate yourself. One, two, three. Shy people. The shy people. Okay. How many would say that there's no conflict there at all? Okay. More people. How many people would say that, you know, faith is better, but we use the tools, kind of? Handful of people, great. How about that there's just a chronic tension, we might as well just learn to live with it? Yeah, okay. And how about that having the outlook that we have can really transform how technology is used? Well, you guys are just spread completely across that continuum. All right, that's gonna help me there. My next line is, that's what I wish I could have known before I came. No, not that though, different show of hands. See, that's what I love about social media. It's always interactive, and so reality is always changing, and you just have to get comfortable with it. So here's how I broke down the week, not knowing what I'd come into, and now I think it's probably right. Tomorrow I want to get a lot deeper into what embodied theology means and embodied faith, and really talk about how we are in the world with each other. Wednesday, I want to do social media, really talk about what that is and what it means for our culture. Thursday, I want to talk about social media and faith, and particularly Unitarian Universalism, share with you some of what CLF is doing and what we've learned from it, because we're kind of the canaries in the coal mines with this. And Friday, I'm not sure yet. I have way too much stuff, and it'll evolve over the week. I'm thinking that at some point in the week, I want to have some kind of a ritual of grief, just to name where we're not anymore, just to really give people a chance to name some of the loss of moving into this river, this now you're even older digital kind of reality. I think it's important to name that. And so somehow we'll do that. If you want to come to the after talks at 3:30, we may have some conversation about that there, or you can always write to me on Facebook or put it on the Twitter channel or whatever you want, just get in touch. So, amazingly enough, I'm supposed to end now, so I'm going to close with a Rumi poem, who can always close anything. This is what Rumi has to say. If you want what visible reality can give, you're an employee. If you want the unseen world, you're not living with your truth. Both wishes are foolish, but you'll be forgiven for forgetting that what you really want is love's confusing joy. So go at it, savor love's confusing joy, and we'll come back tomorrow. Thanks.